This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Hi, I'm Gail.
I'm Nate.
And this is Full Mutuality.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yes, on this episode, on today's episode, our guest will be my very favorite human for Valentine's Day.
So you.
And our audience, you always join us every time, so that's cool.
Oh, that's right. I was talking to the audience. You guys.
You guys, you too. Folks. Happy if you celebrate Valentine's Day. If you don't, well, you're listening to us. And even if this is after Valentine's Day and you're tuning in, we want to do something different for Valentine's Day. We're not the edgy podcast. If you want to listen to an edgy Valentine's Day evangelical deconstruction, I suggest checking out Scott's podcast. Go check out Chapel Probation. An edgy one together.
He just dropped one.
He did.
Yesterday.
He did. And if you are listening to this and it is before the weekend, if you listen to this, we suggest, I mean, even after the weekend, you could probably...
Real quick. Okay, let's put it in a little segment here that we're going to call Announcements.
Announcements. We'll make an announcement before we get into today's Ash Valentine's Day topic. But it's sort of along some similar lines. But on the edgy part of Valentine's Day, which is not going to be... ours is going to be a little less edgy. But if you want to go edgy, we have an announcement.
Just different kind of edgy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Content warning. So
yes,
there is an event happening this weekend in Portland, Oregon. And if you are not able to make it out, if you can't fly on last minute or don't have the weekend available like us, we encourage you to do what we're going to do, which is to download it, to go and sign up.
Live stream it.
Live stream. Or if you can't, if you're busy this weekend, if you have stuff going on, you can literally get access to watch it at your own convenience, which is kind of cool. They're going to have, I mean, lots of people from our Dauntless Network will be there. Megan is helping
put
this in.
So it's being hosted by Megan and Cortland from the Thereafter podcast. So go check them out. As well as Tori from Go Home Bible, You're Drunk, and a whole host of collaborators that they're all working with. Justin's also
part of Go Home Bible, You're Drunk.
Yes.
Scott, who we mentioned about his edgy episode, will be there as well. Speaking with Janice, I believe, together. Janice from God Is Not Given. There'll be a lot of great podcasters in that will be out there. And the topic will be all around topics of sex. So like I said, edgier than what we're doing today.
Yeah.
If you listen to Scott, sort of more on that line.
But I think that's good. Like, there's a place for that too,
absolutely.
Right? When you're sort of deconstructing the evangelical construct surrounding particularly purity culture, and we were never really allowed to talk about sex in any sort of healthy, meaningful way. These sorts of environments are so good for that kind of stuff. So, the event is called Content Warning. And you can head over to contentwarningevent.com to check out all of the information. So if you are listening to us and you live in the Portland area, you can go in person. If you don't, there is an online only option as well. Pricing is there. And yeah, go check out that website. Again, it's contentwarningevent.com, all one word.
Yeah, definitely necessary, definitely important topic. And definitely something we didn't have a lot of opportunity to discuss and think through. And as we leave purity culture and evangelical culture behind, these are important topics. So yeah, you can check that out. What will we be talking about today? I don't want to say it's less important. I said it's not edgy, but you know, on my heart has been this idea of the bad ways we were taught to love, the ways that we were taught to love others or not love others, actually, and the ways that we were taught not to love ourselves. And so as I've been thinking through relationships and what we were taught about them, I want to speak about them in a more general way, you know, the ways that we've been emotionally impacted by teachings about God. And I'll kick us off. I actually put up, and on Full Mutuality on Facebook is usually where I end up putting up a lot of my personal thoughts or things that are on my mind. And That's where people tend to engage the most too, and like write their comments. And so I had posted a thought about how we were taught to keep people at arm's length. And the comment section just was filled with people discussing it. And it was a really fruitful conversation. I think a lot of people were resonating and being like, oh, that's where that comes from in me. Yeah, I before you brought this up, I hadn't thought about it in a while, but actually this still impacts me even today. And I hadn't been able to identify what that was. But what I'd written was, if you came out of evangelicalism, were you taught a fear of loving anyone too much, aka loving them more than God? And so that was sort of what I was throwing out there, with the idea that, you know, basically I thought my devotion to the rules was a sign that I was loving God more. So like if they told me not to love gay people, anything they told me, right? I was like, well, you know, if I felt uncomfortable, I guess it really meant I love God most if I was going to prioritize him, even if it meant loving other people not as well. And then the ways that we were just taught that keeping people at arm's length was somehow spiritual. So my question was, what people were you afraid you loved too much? How did they spiritualize this idea that loving needs to be limited? What was the lingo? I know for myself, I remember idolatry being used. You need to strive to have an undivided heart. God is a jealous God. You remember this one, Nate? How much time did you spend with your family or your friends or your boyfriend, girlfriend versus how much time with God?
Yep.
All those kind of things. Those were sort of thoughts that were thrown at us. And I it was very ambiguous, because it was like, well, how do you know if you're loving God more than other people? Like, do you time your devotionals, your prayer time, start a stopwatch? Okay, how many minutes did I spend with each? And then there's this constant guilt that we just didn't love God enough too. So that was emphasized. And I think feeling like you were loving others more than God was almost a given when you set up that kind of a scenario, right? Like, how do you not love people that you care about more than God? And how can you measure that out? So yeah, that was sort of what I pitched out there. And I wanted to maybe talk through, like, where did we get these ideas from, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the thing that pops out the most is that passage in Luke where Jesus said, like, if anyone follows me and doesn't hate their father and their mother, their wife, their children, their brothers and sisters, etc., then, and even themselves, then that person isn't worthy of following me, or can't be, you know, my disciple. And, you know, the word hate is so strong. And I remember growing up in church and thinking, like, well, how, you know, we're being taught to love one another. How could you hate your family? You know, your husband, your wife, your father, your mother, your brother, sister, how do you hate those people? And I remember, you know, the way that we were taught, that actually meant that your love for Christ should be so all-encompassing that your love for your family will look like hatred.
Like, in comparison.
Oh,
yeah. Gosh, yes. That's exactly how that was. And the first time I stumbled upon, I love that you brought up that passage, by the way. Mm-hmm. I remember that. And as a young evangelical, oh man, a passage that gave you a challenge to be extreme as a young person was like,
oh yeah,
I don't know, like crack to a rebellious teenager. I don't know. Like, it was just like, you're looking for ways to be all in. And sort of evangelicalism is very appealing to young people because it says, like, commit your life to something super extreme, like be radical, you know, be that whole concept of a Jesus freak. Like, DC Talk had that song, Jesus Freak. It was, I love that stuff. I ate it up as a 15-year-old, and definitely, but I still remember being startled by the word hate when I came across it in that passage and being like, wait, didn't the Bible say to love? Like, wasn't that the radicalness, is to love others and to love them so much, and Jesus loving us, that is so much he died for us? Like, what? And like, just being so surprised by that and having to like go to the youth pastor. What does that mean? Why does it say hate and others in the Bible, hating your family? What is that? How come? It seems like a contradiction. And that is exactly what I was told, what you just said, that it was like in comparison to. And C.S. Lewis actually had a quote. I mean, I want to get back to Bible and I like that you're going there with the Bible, because I think there are a lot of Bible stories, and maybe you and I will get into different ones that tie in as we go through mm-hmm. different thoughts and where people come up with these ideas. But before I get back to the Bible, there was a C.S. Lewis quote that I remember hearing and it stuck with me. And then I probably even quote it to other people because I thought it was so profound at the time. And now I'm just like, this is stupid. You know, you ever like think of like the people you quoted back then and thought it was so profound. And now you're like, wow, that was harmful, dumb, messed up, whatever. I don't want to go too far back in my Facebook history. Sometimes I look through my memories and just hit delete on stuff I wrote. I'm just like, I like looking through them to humble myself, to be like, yeah, you used to believe this. This is how much you've grown. But also like, it's sort of a purge to just be like, I no longer cling on to these toxic thoughts. Goodbye. Yeah. Or as Strong Bad would say, deleted. But C.S. Lewis, so this was the quote that I thought was profound. When I have learned to love God better than my earthly dearest, I shall love my earthly dearest better than I do now. Insofar as I learn to love my earthly dearest at the expense of God and instead of God, I shall be moving towards the state in which I shall not love my earthly dearest at all. And yeah, exactly like what I was saying. How on earth do you measure something like this? Like how, yeah. How do you make that gap of showing that you love God so much more? Like the gap is so big that it looks like hate. And then that fear that it instilled in me that like, oh no, wait, if I'm not loving God that much more, then maybe that's me. I'm moving towards the state in which I'm not going to be loving my earthly dearest at all. I mean, I think I'm loving them, but I'm prioritizing them more than God, or I'm putting them ahead of God. So then I'm going to just end up hating them. Like it feels like I was gaslighting myself, you know, like through ideas like this, mm-hmm. in being fearful of loving people too much. And yeah. I know I'm not the only one. I know you're not the only one. People were commenting, people were responding to this with stories and putting them up right there publicly on my page. So I'm gonna go through some of the comments because okay. I thought they were interesting. Somebody actually, I'll go to this one first because we were talking about loving your family and that Bible verse actually that you brought up from Luke. Somebody brought up A.W. Tozer. He is like some giant in the Christian community, supposed to be like the spiritual example. And somebody had quoted, A.W. Tozer had 7 children. His wife was Ada Cecilia. I'm not even going to try her last name. After Tozer died, Ada remarried a man named Leonard. And later, when she was asked about the difference between her marriage to the great man of God and her current husband, she candidly said, I have never been happier in my life. Aiden Tozer loved Jesus Christ, but Leonard loves me. And I mean, that is really powerful.
Yeah.
And I think of different people that I've known in my life who've had dads who are pastors or husbands who are pastors talking about being neglected, talking about how, yeah, they just the ministry first concept and how their mm-hmm. family was treated and how they never felt really cared about by that person who was so about God. And it's interesting because Christianity claims to be about loving other people well, loving your neighbor, love is supposed to be the central component, is love others. And yet that's a common thread, and it comes from a lot of this overall, you know, the verse that you brought up, the C.S. Lewis quote that I gave. Like, that's where this stuff mm-hmm. comes out of, and a whole bunch of really bad Bible stories, or at least the ways that they're presented to evangelical people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean,
speaking of Bible stories.
Bible stories, yes.
Don't we have some Bible stories that we could point to?
I think there's a lot of Bible stories, like in terms of getting this, yeah. these ideas in your head about putting other people last. Like which ones do you think of? What pops in your head first?
Let's see.
Which Bible story do you want to go to first?
I think of, I mean, any.
Oh, so many.
Go ahead. Yeah, you go first.
I'm going to start. I mean, didn't we all hear about Isaac and Abraham and like this idea of like he was about to like give up his kid that he had prayed mm-hmm. about, and God told him would be his blessing and bless the whole world through this kid. And this is the promise. And he's old. It's like, it's not even just he had this kid or this one child. It was like, no, like he was, this was a miracle child of his. And then mm-hmm. God is like, give up this kid.
Yeah. Show me that you love me. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing the whole thing, but you know, show me that you love me by sacrificing your son to me.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, and Abraham goes ahead and
yeah, he's about to do it. I mean, I think what's really weird as an evangelical kid is that they read you these stories as a kid.
Right?
Like, it's so strange that as a little child, you're like, wait, would my parents do this to me? Father-son camping trip?
It's a powerful way to keep people in line, right? And to instill in children at a young age that you need to be obedient to your parents, to your elders, to the people, you know, who are in leadership over you, mm-hmm. Because they reserve the right to sacrifice you to God.
Lovely. What a way to feel secure with your family and parents.
Yeah.
And people have said stories. I've heard people tell stories about how a parent would say to them when they would actually tell them that they loved them, they would say, but I love God more than you. Like, they could never say, I love you without a disclaimer, or even I love your mom, but I love God more than your mom. I love God more than you. And it's like, what's the point in doing that? Like, why can't your love just be what it is? Why can't a child rest in your love? Like, there's a point you're trying to bring up if you can't even express your love without that disclaimer, right? And it's sort of what you're saying. I'm in charge. I might sacrifice you if I need to. You're not the priority here. Yeah, Abraham and Isaac is a really creepy one. I know, you know, the most charitable defenses I've heard of it is like, you know, Abraham would have expected God to resurrect the kid afterwards, but there's nothing in the Bible that
that says that.
No, just people trying to like fix the Bible, because some of the stories are just gross. just mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's another story in the book of Judges, right? The story of this guy named Jephthah.
Oh, yeah. Let's go into the child sacrificing stories, eh? There's not just one.
Yeah. Speaking of child sacrifice.
Yeah. And maybe in the bigger picture, before we get into all the child sacrifice stories, we should maybe look at the ultimate one and say, that's interesting. This is a religion based around God sacrificing his only kid, his only child for us. And that's supposed to be the ultimate act of love. And oh, wow, look, here's a bunch of other examples that kind of parallel this or that flow in line with this. So, yeah.
I think... You know, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think it is worth pointing out that there's a lot of incongruity in the Bible regarding child sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the reason that's given for God wiping out, you know, certain civilizations, certain city states that, you know, they were sacrificing their children to Moloch or whatever, you know, God or deity that society believed in, and this was why God wiped them out. And yet here we have so many different individual stories of God demanding a child sacrifice. So which is it, you know?
Yeah.
Is God gonna have his cake and eat it too, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
he's upset at all those people for their child sacrifices. Guess how God is gonna redeem all of humanity? Guess how? Yeah. The incongruities are definitely there. And I think, you know, theology and how you interpret this obviously is important. And there's probably much better, healthier ways to look at these different things, even the stories themselves. Again, we're talking about them as how they were interpreted to us through evangelical lenses, right? Mm-hmm. Using that evangelical idea that God's, you know, big, beautiful act of redemption for humanity was penal substitutionary atonement through child sacrifice. But yes, Japheth, is that Jephthah? How do we say
Jephthah?
Jephthah, right. That's where you're going with the Judges story.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So if you're not familiar with the story of Jephthah, basically there's this guy who goes off to war, right? And or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he comes back, you know,
he makes a promise before he goes off to war. And he's like, God, if you deliver these enemies into my hands, then I'm going to sacrifice the first thing that I see when I get home.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's implied that he thinks, you know, like one of his donkeys or animals is going to come out and greet him when he arrives home. Like, what?
I don't know what he was thinking. But, you know, it's his daughter. It's his daughter. And he grieves, obviously, that his daughter comes to his young daughter. I don't know. She's a young teenager, mm-hmm. 11, 12. I don't know. Some young age. And he sobs and he cries. And instead of being like, oh, well, that was like a dumb promise I made. No, that's not like, of course I would never sacrifice my kid. It was a silly thing for me to think. He's like, okay, this is what God wants me to do. I got to honor my promise. And, you know, I think when I was told this story in evangelical churches, not only was it given as an example to me of like, God would want you to honor your promise. If you, you know, offered your kid as the deal, then you got to follow through. But they left out like the horrificness of this story, not just in killing his own daughter, but like the fact that he has time to think this over. This is not a rash impulse where later he looks back and goes, oh, maybe I came too quickly that God wanted me to do that. No, he tells her to go off with her friends, take some time to hike in the woods with them, say her goodbye. Mm. Like, he has time to think over, like, is this what God wants me to do? And comes to the conclusion, yep, few days of her enjoying her last days of life, yep, ready to, whew, this is like heavy stuff. And I get why they left that piece out. It's such a gross, yeah.
Yep.
And it could have been told as a story of like, here is how we sometimes misunderstand God or right. what we think our duties to him should look like. Here is right. how parents really mess it up and come to really flawed understandings of what loving God looks like. That could have been a good lesson. You know, it could have been a good way to look at that story of like good, bad examples. You know, don't think good parenting looks like this. Don't think loving God well looks like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Bible doesn't give us like the moral of this story is ... You know, people get to come up with their own interpretations of it.
Yeah. And I think this belief, this set of beliefs ends up manifesting in essentially stunted relationships, evangelicals' inability to care for and love people in a healthy manner, because there's always this thing in the back of their minds that like, you know, am I prioritizing this relationship above my relationship with God?
Yeah.
And so it finds its way into the way that evangelicals at large tend to relate to other people, non-evangelicals in particular. And then it manifests on individual levels and you know, on a case by, you know, person by person basis in the way that they conduct their relationships with their friends, families, and loved ones, you know, and I'm sure that there are people who are listening who have evangelical family who are finding it incredibly difficult to have any real relationship with their family, whether that's parents or, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whoever, because of this sort of hierarchy of relationships, that there isn't any way, like, I think it's this idea that there needs to be some kind of hierarchy, and if I love these people too much, I'm going to end up loving God not enough, which, you know, in the examples that you were sharing, then ends up making me, like what C.S. Lewis says, not love those people properly, because I'm not loving God first, who will then, you know, take that love that I'm giving to God and amplify that and pass it on properly to other people, because I am inherently broken and I don't know how to properly love. Therefore, if I love God, God will take that love and
make it give a pure, unbroken form.
Purify it, right, and give it to others. So I know I just like went all over the place.
No, it was a good rant. That's I do it where all the time.
Well, that's where my mindset was when I was in evangelicalism.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
I hate you, naturally.
And I hate black people.
Things are going to get worse before they get better.
What is presented to me as an American does not look like me.
Because you're not allowed to be a black man in corporate America.
You give us a hard time for being white, being American, and being in control.
And when you live under a situation like that constantly, and then you ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening right now. And you know what? We need a space where we can debrief some of it and deconstruct. If you've been looking for a POC-centered podcast that engages with intersectionality, religion, critical race theory, and some hip-hop culture, then you need to check out Profane Faith. I'll be your host, Daniel White Hodge, and we go in every other week. So check us out wherever you find your podcasts, or check us out at whitehodgepodcasts.com to see what other platforms we're on. Cool? All right. Peace.
I did want to read through some comments because I don't think you're alone, Nate. I was in the same boat as you. And the comments on this thought of, you know, putting people at arm's length and the ways that we kept distance with people in order to love God more. Someone said, oh, absolutely. This made me a Keith. I'll just read first names. Keith was like, oh, absolutely. This made me pull the God card and break up with my first girlfriend when everything was going great. I felt so guilty for loving her too much. Mm. Somebody named Caitlin, I've been thinking about this for a couple of days because the question resonated, but for me, it was something slightly different. I have childhood trauma around the death of a family members. For decades as Christians, I feared my husband dying. Okay, I still do. Sure, it's the trauma, but it's also countless testimonies of God loves me so much, he took away anything that kept me from being completely his. I heard this from a lot of widows. That's some shitty rhetoric there. Jealous God, indeed. Yeah. I mean, the stories people posted up were, they gave me shivers. Like, I was just heartbroken reading through and thinking through, did I hear stories like this in church? And being like, yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. This emphasis on, like, examples of this. Someone else named Tom said, I distinctly remember a fellow evangelical friend of mine in college telling me he broke up with his girlfriend, whom he adored, because he felt like he was cheating on God with her. Mm. Oh, man. Cheating on God with your girlfriend. Woo. Yeah. Kayla said, not quite the same, but the nuclear family was put above all else. My parents did not have other adult friends because your spouse should be your friend. And anytime we started making friends and spending, quote unquote, too much time with them, we were told we had to stop and put the family first. As a result, I have an incredibly difficult time making friends now as an adult. Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah. Yep. April. I remember once in youth group, after a whole series on this, we had a bonfire to burn all the things we loved more than God. My entire CD collection full of late 90s, early 2000s emo punk and pop music went up in flames. Oh, man, that brings back memories. Like,
yeah,
I feel like that's the difference between the fundamentalist kids and the evangelical kids. Is you guys weren't allowed to have it. So you weren't burning it because you had to pretend you had like your stash.
I had to pretend that I didn't know what those things were. So
you had to hide it.
Yeah, I had to hide the fact that I had that CD collection.
Get that Evanescence CD with that edgy cover under your bed or something.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that was a good debut album. Come on.
It was. And then for us evangelical kids, we weren't told it was evil. Like, I know you guys had like there's some satanic beat or something, rock music, or I forget, you know, what lines were in the IFB circles, but I know that for evangelical, because we weren't told the music was evil, it was more like, well, how does this direct your thoughts towards God? And look at the Christian music. It keeps you focused on Jesus. And so it was like a guilting into. So like the burning your CDs was definitely getting rid of them, throwing them out. Happened. So many people have this story because, yeah, I mean, I remember even encouraging people to focus on their Christian stuff and listen. And I committed to doing that at different points as well. So definitely something that was taught and passed along. Somebody named Pamela said, they were always looking for idols. No one was allowed to just enjoy anything, dear God. Yeah. Oh, Amanda said, God, yes. And it's still messing with me 20 plus years later with like sad emoji. Whew.
Yeah, that's tough. Mm-hmm. You know, like where, when, and this is something that I think about often, you know, when we leave these spaces, especially those of us who were so devoted to our faith and this belief system, it walking away from that can be really like it, even, you know, for a long, long time afterwards. I think, you know, probably to throughout the rest of our lives, we're going to be dealing with these, you know, scars from the world that we came from, the inability to have healthy relationships, you know, like what Kyla was saying about to this day, they have an incredibly different time making friends as an adult because they were never taught how to develop healthy friendships and relationships. They never were able to practice that in the real world because they were always taught that this is the relationship that comes first and everything else must, you know, be cast aside or look like hatred.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like if you develop a pattern of keeping people at arm's length and you spiritualize that throughout your formative years that you're going to just, you know, unpack that belief and you're going to flip a switch and now you're going to be good at letting people in and trusting people and being comfortable loving people and knowing how to do that, right? Like that's a process. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's going to feel very foreign and difficult for a long time, and it's going to be a deliberate effort to change a pattern like that, right?
Yeah.
Oh, some of the stories were a lot more heartbreaking than others. I mean, we're talking about child sacrifice, but somebody had commented on a friend of mine was sharing it, and they said they were afraid that their husband loved them too much and that he would go to hell for it. And then when they had their first miscarriage, they were wondering if they were being punished for being so excited about the pregnancy. Add this to being raised by a parent who actively destroyed your happiness because they couldn't bear to see you happy. And it's a little wonder you have anxiety. So yeah, that story resonated with me a lot because I was the whole God might take away my child to teach me something or to punish me was something I actually have dealt with. When I was pregnant with my daughter, I got pregnant as a teenager outside of marriage. And I was taught about purity culture and that, you know, this was you can't have sex outside of marriage. It's a sin. And so God was going to punish me. And the story, going back to the Bible stories, the story that stuck with me was David and Bathsheba and God punishing David for his disobedience to God by that child dying. And I remember being terrified that I could miscarry or that God was going to punish me this way. And then I committed to being a born again virgin and I did that. Sorry, I'm just laughing at the stupid terms, but like the terrifiedness I had at like, God could kill my kid to teach me something was. Okay.
So I think it's worth taking a quick moment here and just acknowledging what the fuck is a born again virgin. I know that like our audience most likely I'm guessing like 90% of you guys know what that is.
You probably are laughing and know what this is. But if you don't, you know,
for those of you who are joining us who have no frame of reference for the evangelical speak, what the hell is this?
What the heck is that? So a born again Christian is somebody who's born again. There's a passage in the Bible where it says, you know, you must be born again. And the interpretation by evangelicals is like, well, you say the sinner's prayer and you become a Christian. Basically, they mean an evangelical Christian because that's like the most valid type of Christian in their minds and beliefs that echo theirs on, you know, what salvation looks like. And then basically you're saved now. So they might, and like evangelicals don't even like that title, evangelical. So usually they like titles like, are you born again? Are you saved? Like, those are the questions they'll ask instead to figure out if you're evangelical. Right. And that's where that comes from. So a born again virgin, going back to that, would be like, you've instead of dedicating your life to Christ, you've rededicated your virginity to God and you are no longer going to have sex. So yeah. A little bit embarrassing now, but I think I'm telling this story because this idea that God would kill your baby is horrifying. But I understand where I pulled that from. You know, somebody could say, oh, I never taught you those things. You know, any evangelical pastor leader of mine could be like, Gail, you had some misunderstandings about God. We never taught you that. But then you look at the Bible stories and how they get framed and it makes complete sense. Like it, yeah. And I want to go back to some child sacrifice stories because there's more. And I mean, I mentioned David and Bathsheba, but there's other ones. There's Job. There's Job and basically God gambles. I mean, we mentioned this in our first episode back in a while on our update of life, but we were talking about Good Omens near the end and how there was a really fantastic episode in season 2 retelling of Job that I think, go watch it, but I won't get into all that. Can go listen to that episode.
Yeah. That's an involuntary child sacrifice. So that's an instance where
Job didn't make that decision.
Right. Job didn't make the decision. And it wasn't, you know, and in the case of Abraham, you know, God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. But, that was a decision that Abraham came to. Jephthah, similarly, decision that Jephthah came to. But in the case of Job, Job was a victim of circumstances.
But God made that decision. Right.
God made that decision, but he didn't ask Job. He didn't say, hey, Job, give me your child. It was like
David and Bathsheba. It's like God's making the ultimate call of like how to. And it's such a crappy story in the sense that God is like, hey, Satan, look at this guy of mine. He loves me so much. He's such a, look at an honorable man Job is. And Satan's like, oh, yeah, it's just because you protected him and given him a good life. Well, what if you took those good things away from him? You know, let's see if he'd still love you then. And so like God's like literally just gambling with Satan and being like, okay, you can do anything to him. You can't touch him, but yeah. Killing his kids is up on the table and he does.
Yep. And that's just to be fair, that is a very, very, very modern approach to that story. That is putting all sorts of layers in translation and the fact that, you know, the English translation uses the name Satan there because it comes from that ancient Hebrew word ha-satan, which simply means adversary or accuser and is used in a few other instances to describe other people in the Bible. So this character that we're calling Satan isn't necessarily even the Satan character or Lucifer that we think of when we think of Satan. This is just an adversarial character in the book of Job, and a lot of that lore and mythology hadn't even really been developed at the time that Job was supposedly written. So just want to make sure that like people are aware that these are all interpretations. Everything like that we're bringing to the table here are all interpretations, but these are interpretations that we were raised with and that we were taught and brought up with.
Yes, absolutely. And there's other ones. I mean, aside from the Job one, other ones that we were, you know, presented with. I mean, I think of Lot and his daughters and how, you know, these visitors / messengers, angels appear and the whole town comes out because they want a giant orgy and they want unconsensual sex. And that never gets brought up in how evangelicals speak of that story. But basically, Lot offers up his daughters to be raped and is willing to sacrifice his daughters in order to protect these men of God, quote unquote, these messengers of God. And it's presented as like, look how much Lot cares for God. You know, and that's how I was told that story. Look at how wicked the city was. That this is a setup for, you know, us understanding why God had to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Look how bad a place this was. Mm-hmm. But like these daughters, And what happened to them? Like, it's just like a bump on the road, like that's passed over real quick. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no horror. There's no moment of disgust, of revulsion at what Lot's doing here. offering his daughters unconsensually to be harmed, to be mm-hmm. raped. Like, consent, again, not a strong topic in evangelical circles at all, and what love looks like.
Not to mention the fact that later on in that story, Lot's daughters get Lot really, really drunk, and they rape their own father because they want to have kids. So it's
a mess. The Bible is
By the way, this is the collection of books that people are
Moms
trying
for
to
liberty
say,
get this, are not
get this back
to
into
banned.
School, right? get the Bible back. You know what the problem is? The Bible isn't in school. We aren't teaching kids these stories,
right? Yeah, those groomer stories that they're trying to put in the kids' library. But these stories, no, these are our kid-appropriate mm-hmm. stories. Bible needs to be taught in school.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Man. The ways the Bible gets sanitized, it's something else. But I mean, this is the setup to Lot's wife. And that's another example of, I think it ties into this whole loving God more than other people. The story of Lot's wife being so this all gets explained away by how corrupt and horrible Sodom and Gomorrah was. And basically God tells them to leave, to flee and not to look back. And Lot's wife turns around. I mean, these are her friends. This is where she lived. This is her community. And it's burning. She's told to run and it's just burning to the ground. And so she turns to look and gets punished by God. And she's turned into a pillar of salt for looking back, for disobeying, for caring. It's not framed as because she cared. It's like, no, she loved wickedness and immoral people more than she loved God. And so these are the stories and these are the morals that were told from these stories. I think there are ways to tell stories that can pull all kinds of different, you can analyze these kind of ancient texts with different angles and different lenses. Mm-hmm. But as evangelicals, like you said, these are the ways that we had come at these stories. These were the lessons we were being told. So when people are afraid, you know, that God would take away their child or their spouse or their parents, like these thoughts didn't come out of thin air. Like they were backed up by, well, here's an example from the, like, evangelical kids are raised with the Bible so much more than any other group of Christian people will be raised mm-hmm. with the Bible. It's drilled into you. You listen to Bible stories every single Sunday, multiple. And so you hear all about it, and these are the things you're being taught. So you come up with these ideas out of the stories that you're also being told. I don't know if you've seen this image of Jesus. There was this image of Jesus asking a girl for her teddy bear. Mm-hmm. Seen that one?
Yeah.
So the picture has, I'm going to just describe it. There's a little girl standing in front of Jesus who's on his knees, and the girl's holding her favorite teddy bear in her hands. And Jesus has behind his back an enormous big teddy bear. And she goes, "But I love this." And she's holding her little teddy bear. And he goes, "Trust me, I have better for you." And at the bottom, it says, "Trust God. What he has is way better and bigger." This one reminds me of Job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do we need to take away this little girl's teddy bear? Why is Jesus hiding this big bear behind his back and acting like she even wants that big bear?
Yeah.
Right. You know?
Right.
That's going to be fine for her to give up her favorite. Like, yeah. And I saw this circulating from so many.
Yeah. And I get the sentiment of, you know, like, you know, difficult circumstances come along. We lose people that we love. We experience tragedy and loss in life. And, you know, a way to comfort ourselves is perhaps to think that, like, God has something bigger and better for us on the other side of this. But the insidious nature of this particular type of teaching is that we're taught to sacrifice those things in order to experience the bigger and better things that God has in store for us, that maybe, our heart is too tied to those people, those relationships, those things that we are incapable of seeing what's ahead of us, what God has in store for us, which, on the one hand, in a way, it kind of makes sense, right? You can often miss the forest for the trees in a lot of circumstances. But the problem with this is that behind all of this is a God that is personified, is a God that is sort of humanized, that's anthropomorphized. And if you have a God that's all powerful and supposedly all loving behind the scenes in all of this, then these sorts of actions by that God are sadistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is twisted. This is a game that he's playing with our lives, with our feelings, with our relationships, with our, who we are, you know?
Yeah, the sadistic God point. That's a great one. And I actually wanted to read an Instagram quote. It's from Just That Faye. I believe they're XJW. That's their background. And I think as ex-evangelicals, it's good to think about how we get to be in community with so many other people who leave high control groups. Mm-hmm. We get to be in support of ex-Mormons, ex-XJWs. Like, it's interesting to me that we were taught to keep these people at arm's length as evangelicals, because they weren't quote unquote real Christians. They were in a cult. But then as you leave a high control group like evangelicalism, you realize these are your people because they understand. You guys have that in common, that understanding mm-hmm. of this. So this is something they posted and I related to it as an ex-evangelical. My first abusive relationship was with God. Conditioned not to trust myself, to not think for myself, to not listen to my needs, to repress natural desires and feelings, conditioned to believe I'm worthless, broken, and sinful, conditioned to believe I need to be saved, and in order to be saved, I need to submit myself completely to his will, whatever may come, threatened that if I ever spoke up against the abuse or voiced my questions, I would be shunned. All in all, that I was taught to believe this was from a loving God. And just that idea of that relationship to God, that first abusive relationship is with God. And that God is claimed to be the person that will love you the most. Like mm-hmm. no one can love you more than God. Mm-hmm. And this is how God treats you. And I even think of like things like women being taught that, you know, Jesus is your boyfriend. And this is like you're talking about the weird phrases like born again virgin, the whole yeah. Jesus is your boyfriend. And somebody brought it up and I've been pondering that this statement over, but like this idea of Jesus is your boyfriend, then women are being taught like power imbalances straight off in relationships. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. Jesus should not be your boyfriend. Teachers should not date students. Lawyers should not, psychologists should not date their patients. Like whenever there's like this big difference in knowledge and understanding and someone having power over you, that's an unethical relationship. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah. Christians and ethics, sexual ethics are just not a thing.
Right.
That's a very bad ethic. So mm-hmm. the whole Jesus is your boyfriend concept kind of sets up some of those really unhealthy parameters of what mutual healthy relationships should look like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few comments more. I wanted to read some thoughts from people that commented. I wanted to share some of these. If you ever, you know, want to share your thoughts, feel free to go over to Full Mutuality on Facebook. Feel free to share if there's a post that resonates with you.
Or head over to fullmutuality.com and hit the contact page or the
you can get a hold of us in any way you button. Want
absolutely
through any of our it's socials just that, or
you know I like let's push people to the web to the website because we're paying for it so
or support us in our Patreon yeah. so that we can pay for our website hosting. We appreciate all of you, by the way, who are supporting us in that, and means so much to us. I'll go back to reading because I love hearing from people. Aaron said, "That all sounds familiar. I was also taught at some point that it was a sin to love your pets. Love was to be reserved for God and people, since people have souls." Elizabeth, who comments often on our page, I really appreciate her thoughts. She said, "Oh yeah, something about God being jealous, giving away pieces of our heart, competing affections, making disciples, not friends. There always had to be a hierarchy. We can never just be equals." El Huther, they said, "I was told as a child that if I loved someone or something more than God, he might take it them away from me so that I could rely more on him. The people I loved most in the world were my parents. I naturally felt like I loved them more than God, so I was constantly terrified that God would kill my parents. This was just one of many evangelical-related anxieties I had as a child." And our friend of the podcast, Kalista, and our friend in real life, she commented, always, there was always the fear that if I love my family, friends, partner, or children more than God, they had become an idol. So I had to figure out how to love God more or love my family less. And it's extremely difficult to love a God who's not actually present more than those who are. Conjuring up feelings for an imaginary deity more deep and powerful than for anyone else is impossible. So there was always a bit of guilt involved in loving, which often resulted in holding back love from others. Being away from all that has made loving much more free, but it's a learning process. The training is not always easy to recognize and unlearn. This post was a good reminder for me for why I sometimes struggle with letting people closer. That was how I was trained. It's not who I am. And I think I'll leave it with that comment as the last comment I'd want to read, because we can unlearn it, but it is a process. Mm-hmm. And it's not who we are if we have a struggle to love people. It's a product of a lot of the conditioning that we've had and how we've been taught. How we've been taught even to think of ourselves. And I want to go there. I think that's the last thing I want to discuss before we close off, is this idea of, I mean, I started with how we were taught to love others and not love them too much, not love them more than God. But there's an important element of how we were taught to not love ourselves, or how we were taught to think of ourselves, that factors in. And the whole idea of God being their first abusive relationship and what they were taught about themselves factors in, ties into this very nicely. But do you remember that expression, JOY, Nate? Do you remember that acronym? What was it for you? Because I think
Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between.
Aha, that's how you were taught it. So us, it was Jesus first, others second, yourself last. Kind of the same, mm-hmm. just taught in a different way. But yeah, yourself last. So joy was in putting yourself last. So your needs, again, they shouldn't be the factor that makes you decide things, right? If someone is treating you poorly, well, that's yourself. You don't matter. Mm-hmm. So that goes by the wayside. And I've been thinking that over a lot. And I saw, I'm going to read another quote that I saw online by Jerry Henderson. And the quote was, "It's normal to grieve the person you might have become without the trauma you experienced. And a part of healing is learning to see the beautiful person you are right now." And I thought of this, and I was reflecting on this comment, because I was thinking that a big part of our healing is learning to love ourselves right now. But it's hard to even want to get to know yourself if you're scared that who you are underneath is bad. And, you know, this thought came to me as I was thinking about evangelical teachings of total depravity, or even that, you know, you're like filthy rags, or your heart is deceitfully wicked. You know, all the doctrines that they've taught us that basically keep us from knowing ourselves at the end, because we're afraid that who we are is bad. And I think of how, you know, if we wouldn't have had that trauma of all those doctrines on how bad we are, that we might have actually gotten to know ourselves sooner. But I don't think it's too late. Like, I don't think it's too late to get to know your own self and to learn how to care about yourself. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Think of that ancient Greek philosophical saying, know thyself. What is it? Gnothi seuton, or whatever, however you say that. Clearly I paid attention in Greek class. But yeah, I think of, it stands out to me. One of my favorite movies when I was growing up was The Matrix. And there was that, you know, that scene where Neo is speaking with the Oracle, and she's got that saying above her mantle, or above her door in the kitchen. And, you know, it's in Greek. And she says, you know what that means? It means know thyself. And that's the root of, I think, any kind of healthy existence in the world and in society is to know ourselves. And evangelical Christianity and evangelical thought and practice actively works against us ever truly knowing ourselves, ever truly like reflecting on who we are and getting to know who we are as people. Because we're always constantly trying to suppress any thought or belief or urge or idea that pulls us away from Christ. And remember that, what was that Bible verse? Said, take every thought captive for Christ or something like that.
Yeah. Make it obedient to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sad. When you can't get to know yourself because you're scared that who you are is actually a bad person and who you are is a broken person. I started looking up Ash Wednesday, and you know, that's where Valentine's Day falls today. So, it was about brokenness, and about more than that. And I'm not super familiar with Ash Wednesday as a part of my evangelical tradition, but the word brokenness to me might even mean something very different, you know, than just reflecting on brokenness in the world. When I look at the teachings about being broken and brokenness, it was just a constant sense of making you feel ashamed of being human, of making mistakes, of the fact that, you know, as people, we're in development, we grow, we learn, we drop things sometimes, we do all kinds of little oopses here and there, and we're not paying attention when someone is trying to tell us something sometimes, or like there's just so many things that are human, like they're us just being human, normal, regular people. But if you're constantly being told that you are a sinner, that you are unworthy, that you are bad, then you don't get space to be human. You don't get space to just give yourself love and care for being you and enjoying yourself. It's just a constant, I'm bad, I'm terrible. And so getting to know yourself is a really scary idea if you've been taught that you are underneath the most terrible thing. You know, I think of passages where Paul said, you know, wretched man that I am, you know, who could deliver me, and saying he's the worst of sinners. And if Paul is saying that, then we were all supposed to imagine ourselves as terrible as well. Like this was some sort of a model of a pious Christian, is to just view yourself as gross and horrible, wretched sinner. These are labels that stick to you. They're not easy to just take off. And if you have that belief on a deep down level, then it's hard to get to know yourself. It's very hard to open yourself up to getting to know yourself because you're scared of what you might find. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. And with that, we suggest therapy. yeah. And that can be hard to come by. I know that probably a lot of people aren't able to access mental health. I know at least in the US there's, you know, bigger and bigger pushes for mental health awareness. So hopefully that if you're listening to this, you have good insurance coverage that provides some of that for you. If you do, or even if you don't, and you know, you could find a therapist who operates on a sliding scale, that'd be helpful. But one resource that we turn to a lot and we constantly recommend is the Reclamation Collective.
Mm-hmm.
They have support groups, non-clinical support groups that you can join to work through some of your spiritual trauma.
I've done spiritual abuse with the Reclamation Collective in the support group, and I didn't have insurance access, so you know, it was very affordable. And you had like 10 sessions, and it was, you know, it was a gift to myself, actually, mm-hmm. that I bought for myself, was to be able to process religious trauma that I'd gone through in a group.
Yeah. And they also have a provider network, a provider directory with therapists who are in their kind of... you know, I get directory.
Well, we should stick that in the show notes. I know we've done it before. We've had Kayla on, if you want to search for that episode with Kayla Felton,
who is one of the co-founders of the Reclamation Collective.
Yeah.
And I highly, highly recommend, like, that conversation I go to every once in a while, because it's good to hear that stuff again. So I recommend it. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back through our archives. I believe it's in season one.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to end on that note. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're struggling with getting close to others, be patient with yourself. It's a process. Same with loving yourself and getting to know yourself, and whatever supports that you can have, you know, even just one of the fun things about listening to podcasts is being able to hear other people's stories. And, you know, so I was reading through the comments because so many of you guys were sharing your own stories, and it touched me to just hear from people and hear how that resonated with you. And sometimes there's just a lot of healing to be done in speaking the stuff out loud and journaling and writing out our thoughts and connecting the dots on how things have impacted us, mm-hmm. bringing those things into the light and taking a look at them, a critical look at them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So I think that'll do it for today. If you want any other resources, you know, hit up the show notes, visit us at fullmutuality.com. Also check out the dauntless.fm website. There are other resources there, as well as our Dauntless Media Collective Discord server where you can have
conversations. I'm going to be like, people. We got a lot of conversations on different topics going on there, but it's nice because mm-hmm. it's like, it's not just our podcast. It's like, you'll have the people from the other podcasts as well running deconstruction podcasts or evangelical podcasts mm-hmm. who definitely are there to support and have been doing that and highlighting people's stories. So it's a great network of cool people.
Yeah. And all of that is completely free. You don't have to sign up for anything.
You have to be a part of any Patreon.
Well, you have to put your credit card or anything. you don't have to pay for anything to join. You can just go ahead and sign up. So, we'll put all of those links in the show notes. And we will be back tomorrow, actually.
Yeah, this is a bonus episode. Yeah. We've thrown this in for free for all of you.
Yeah.
We don't just episodes behind a paywall. This is for you all.
Yeah. I mean, all of our episodes are free.
Yeah.
But but this one is just a little extra. So tomorrow we'll be back with a regularly scheduled episode that we are really, really excited for you to hear. I know I say that a lot.
But we're always
really, really excited. Yep. I'm always really excited about the stuff
that we
put
out. That's why
we do this. Yeah. All right. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Full Mutuality Podcast. We're so glad you decided to join us today.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and pretty much every other podcast app. Just search for Full Mutuality on your app of choice or visit our website, fullmutuality.com, for links to all the apps you can subscribe to us on.
And if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd love it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on our website. A quick review is one of the best ways you can support us.
Speaking of support, you can also partner with us on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you'll be helping us produce this podcast, and you'll get access to other content such as exclusive episodes, access to occasional live stream recording sessions, and more. Just head over to patreon.com/fullmutuality to sign up.
Thank you again for hanging out with us today, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Full Mutuality Podcast.
This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.